So tonight I want to speak about seeing the world or our life through Dharma eyes. And let me explain what I mean by that. You know when you observe, you watch the news on TV, or even you listen to it on the radio, we're shown a clip of a news event that is 30 seconds long, and we see the event with our own eyes. And then they have commentators on the news that explain what you just saw, and they explain for 30 minutes or more. And after hearing the commentators chatter for 30 minutes on something that took 30 seconds, we then massage it further in our own mind for another 30 hours. How do we understand what we actually saw? Do we trust our own eyes and ears and our own thought processes and awareness to understand what happened? Or do we listen to the spinmeisters on the left, or the spinmeisters on the right, the spinmeistresses, men and women who have their particular angle on things? Or do we just feel confused? Or do we have a reaction to, one, the spinning on the left or the spinning on the right, or spinning however? You can see that it's not really easy. It's not clear. It's not unambiguous when we try to understand what happens in an event. And this is a pretty, this is something newsworthy that you can see out there. And the same thing is going on inside our own heart, mind, body experience. Stuff happens to us. Life unfolds. Gradually we grow older. What's happening? How do we understand what's happening? Well, we understand what's happening because mom and dad, or their surrogates, chattered away to us endlessly to establish a certain way of understanding what's happening, what's going on. And so when you start crying when you're a little kid, or you start acting out and you get reprimanded, we learn our parents' spin on life. And we learn our teacher's spin. And we learn our government's spin. And we learn our neighborhood's spin. And our life is spun around a lot. And we end up living a life that we could hardly say is our own. We're living out the expectations of others. We're living out opinions of others. We're living out the commands or demands or expectations of others. And we evaluate ourselves by how well we're doing. And we didn't ask for these spun standards in our life, but we all have them. So when you look at your life as those of us who come to the Dharma do, we're looking to understand our life and why and how we suffer, why we suffer, what's the cause of our suffering, how to be free of suffering. Which of the spinmeisters in your heart and mind are you going to believe? Who is it that is kind of writing the script for your life? do we actually or ever have the opportunity to write our own script? Or do we at best get to be aware of acting out others' scripts for us? It's a serious question, because the world out there is changing dramatically. It's really changing extraordinarily in ways that we're barely able to comprehend. I get a first-hand glimpse of it every time I go to Burma. And I've been visiting very remote villages. And these are villages that there's no electricity, there's no running water. They're all farmers. Mostly they're not educated in an academic school. They're more educated in the school of life and farming. And if they've been to one or two grades, that's normal. The most educated person in the village is usually the midwife, who's had a few years of advanced education. And these people are living an agrarian lifestyle, subject to the political changes and the economic changes that are going on in Burma that they hardly understand, hardly know about, let alone understand. And now, unexpectedly and completely unlike any other year they've experienced, the monsoons don't stop when they always have in September. So farmers are very confused as to, well, what is going on and what can they plant and why not and what. And they're living in a world that's changing so fast that I'm not sure they can, well, certainly those traditional societies in those little villages is not going to survive. We ask ourselves when we go there and we take in a solar panel for the midwife to have a refrigerator for the immunizations that she has to administer. Of course, she runs a refrigerator and the radio, the TV, the whatever it is that can operate off that battery. So when you go to these villages, we're met by the local leaders of the village. And usually there's a gaggle of teenage girls wearing their traditional ethnic costumes, you'd say, or traditional ethnic clothing. Very colorful. It's things you see in National Geographic. So we were having a meeting talking about building a clinic in this one village, and after the meeting, the whole half the village was in this building, and we were just talking about how many people would be served and where the building would be built and what are the major diseases and things like that. We decided to build a clinic. So I turned to the teenage girls that were nearby and just saying, well, how old are you? Well, they're 14, 16. I said, oh, because I've asked this question before, I said, at what age do the girls in this village get married? And they said, 18. Every girl in the village gets married at 18. If you're going to get married, you get married at 18. And they explained to me that just a few years ago, even when they were living, the age when all the girls got married was 14. And I asked them, well, what happened? And they said, motorbikes came to the village. Motorbikes came to the village. When cheap Chinese motorbikes were affordable, someone of the whole village would get together, buy one, and the young men would ride it back and forth. And somehow that exposed them to the world outside just enough that it changed the demographic pattern of getting married from age 14 to 18. Their world is changing right up underneath them. And so is ours. So what way of understanding life? What way of understanding the world? What way of understanding our responsibilities to each other, our family, our communities, the environment? What ways of understanding are going to serve us well? And how are we going to, know? Is it just a crapshoot? Or is there really some way to know? Dharma eyes, or seeing through Dharma eyes, is to listen and to try to understand how the Buddha saw things. And it's not so much the Buddha. The Buddha articulated it, but it's really when we see through Dharma eyes, we see through the eyes of the way things are, rather than the way we'd like to believe, the way we've been told to believe, the way we hope to believe, but rather the way things really are. So when we sit, you know, for 35 minutes like you just did, and I offer you some instruction, and many of you have had other teachers and other forms of instruction, and you sit there and you do what you do for 35 minutes, what do you learn? What do you actually come away with in that 35 minutes? Gee, I didn't do very good. I couldn't follow my breath. Well, that's just my spin, or some other teacher's spin that said you should follow, you should pay attention to the breath. And when you evaluate your experience from that angle, didn't do so good. So maybe you're just sleepy. Maybe just, you know, like many of us worked all day, kind of rushed out of the house to get here, and just kind of dull, and not very mindful, not very continuous, and not even aware whether you were mindful or not. And so you have an opinion about that. You have an opinion about your practice, you have an opinion about yourself, that comes from something other than your own experience. It comes from what you've read, what you believe is supposed to happen, what you think should happen, what your teachers have asked you to do. How many of you could have that kind of experience, knowing the experience for just as it was, just what it was, and be totally okay with that? And why not? Because that's the way it is. To really see, oh, this is the way it is, and to be okay with that, is very difficult. Because we have so many views and opinions inside of our mind already. From teachers, authorities, our partners, society, the government, and not just one. And they certainly aren't all headed in the same direction. They're all not spinning in the same direction. They're not spinning at the same speed. It's just a cacophony of, well, views and opinions. And so the Buddha understood this, or the Bodhisattva understood this, and looked at his own mind, his own experience, to try to understand which way of understanding experience leads to the least suffering. Because, let's face it, we all want to be happy. None of us want to suffer. We're all looking. Our life is it's just a scramble of strategies and plans and attempts to hold together a sense of security and happiness and meaning in our life as conditions around us are changing faster than in the village of Burma. We're doing the best we can. And yet, you know, when you really, in the quiet moments of your own self-reflection, how's it going? How's it going for you? Is it really as good as it looks like on the outside to others? Or is there some tension, some fear, some, you know, acceptance of good enough? which is not yet free of suffering. Because how we understand our experience is going to make all the difference in the world of whether we are suffering or not. And when I first heard the word suffering as the translation of the word dukkha, I didn't get it. I mean, I was young, in my mid-20s, full of it, whatever it was, and, had my whole life, except for the first 20-some years, ahead of me, and the horizon was so far away that it was never going to come. And to hear the word suffering was, I could not grok it. I just couldn't get it. It's like, I didn't think my life was suffering. I didn't have a very stable job. I didn't have any money. And I was still wandering around after university, not knowing what I was going to do, what I was going to become when I grew up. But I didn't think I was suffering. Because in my mind, suffering meant I was a failure. Now I understand that dukkha doesn't mean if you suffer, you're a failure. It means if you suffer, you're aware. Because there is suffering. There's pain in our life. There's vulnerability. There's insecurity. There's stress in our lives. To deny that is many people's spin. Like it's not okay to suffer. It's not okay to be stressed. It's not okay to feel vulnerable. It's not okay to be insecure. And yet, that's the way it is for us. Can we so trust our own experience, what our own awareness tells us that we can and are willing to live with that? This is what Dharma practice involves, is really coming to know ourselves so intimately that we don't hide things in the closet. We don't sweep things under the carpet. But we take a look and we see those skeletons in the closet and the dust heaps under the carpet and the places that traditionally the spin meisters of our life would like to keep out of sight. And why do we do that? Why is it important that we look at our life and come to understand it as it is? I don't want to say come to understand it as we do, because what view do we have that's genuinely ours? It's not just kind of a rehashing of someone else's views and opinions of how it should be or how it will be, even when you're doing Dharma practice. Now, even doing Dharma practice, all Dharma practices cultivate wholesome qualities of mind. Awareness, compassion, understanding, patience, loving kindness, renunciation, generosity. All of them, whether you're practicing generosity or sila, living an ethical life, or practicing meditation, learning how to calm down the mind, or whether you're opening to insight, whether you're practicing gratitude practice or service of one sort or another. They're all about cultivating wholesome qualities of mind. Why do we do that? Well, to the extent that we cultivate wholesome qualities of mind, the unwholesome qualities, which are their, we'll say, polar opposites, are not apparent. Maybe they're suppressed, maybe they're uprooted, maybe they're understood, but they are lessened in our experience. That's good. But so much of Dharma practice isn't about enjoying wholesome states of mind.
For those of you who really delved into your meditation practice of awareness in one form or another, you see all kinds of mental states that are not that wholesome, if you're looking correctly, if you're willing to see and really willing to understand, oh, this is the way it is in here, in this mind. And I use that word willing because it really is an attitude of mind that is a great ally in our Dharma practice, in our awareness. Just to ask ourselves, am I willing to experience this moment fully? Without expectations, without anybody else's spin on it, without even my own spin on it. Can I see this moment for what it is? Do I trust myself enough to actually feel this moment and understand it, and then to act on our understanding? We may be wrong in the light of others' views and opinions, but how are we going to know? We can read what the Buddha said. We can hear what contemporary teachers of the Buddhist teachings say. But ultimately, each one of us has to look at our own life and read the book of our own life to understand it. There's no formula. There is only a growing willingness and a capacity to see the world through Dharma eyes, meaning to see our life through the eyes of the truth. And the truth is the way things are. And it takes an extraordinary diligence of mind, a continuity of attention, to develop the power of mind to see through the spin. Everything we experience, everything you have ever experienced or ever will experience, is natural. It's natural. There's nothing weird about it. There's nothing unnatural about it. It is the result of causes and conditions which you may not fully understand, but it's not a mistake. If you could really believe that, if you could really take that into your heart and look at what's going on there and say, and understand, this is natural. There's nothing unnatural about this. This isn't a mistake. The way I'm feeling right now is not a mistake. It is the natural result, the lawful result of causes and conditions, which I may not understand, but which are natural, and this experience couldn't be any other than the way it is. We don't need to fix it. We need to see the way it is and try to understand it. Because it is in understanding our life, the moments of our life, the experiences of our life, that we're going to suffer or not. And if we don't understand correctly, meaning, if we don't understand the way things really are, we can be sure we're going to live out of alignment with them. And when we live out of alignment with the way things are, we live with a sense of struggle, with a sense of it's not okay, or stress, or oppressed. You know the word dukkha. I've heard this. I'm not a scholar and I'm not a linguist, but I've heard that the word dukkha
comes from the experience of riding in an ox cart that has an uneven hub of the wheel that you're riding in. Well, when I went to Burma in December, one of the fellows that was traveling with me, it was his first time going to Burma. He's kind of a farmer. He was fascinated by the ox cars. A lot of places we go, they do all the work by ox cars. And there are places we've gone where you have to ride in an ox car. We didn't need this year, but he really wanted to ride in an ox car. He knows the validity of the word dukkha, because it is painful, to say the least. When we live out of alignment, like the wheel or the hub of the ox cart, our life is dukkha. It is really full of dukkha. Awareness tells us that it's time to fix the hub. But the hub is our heart. It's how are we understanding this experience. If we understand it as a source of suffering, we can be sure it's not an accurate understanding. Because the Buddha talked about the understanding that leads to the end of suffering. He called it right view. But right has a lot of moral connotations that wisdom doesn't have. But it means the view of things, the view of life, the view of experience that leads to less suffering or the end of suffering. So we'll call it right view. The Buddha said, or I should say Sariputta, the second to the Buddha in wisdom, in explaining about right view, or the correct view, or the view that leads to the end of suffering, in explaining this to some fellow monks who inquired, he said, there are two elements to this view. We'll call it the Dharma view. Dharma being the truth, right view meaning the right way of seeing things that leads to the end of suffering. Okay, so the right view, or the Dharma view, the two essential elements of the Dharma view are you need to hear it from someone else first. That sounds like spin, doesn't it? It's like you got to hear this view from somebody else, and it's probably not on NBMSC or whatever it is, or Fox Radio or whatever. So we hear it from the Buddha. But not only do we need to hear it first, we then need to develop wise attention, the continuity of attending to experience, which we practiced for 35 minutes earlier this evening. It is that continuity of attention, the wise attention, that is going to confirm for you the wisdom of this view. And if in your own direct observation of your life, moment by moment, if in that you can see the lessening of suffering, then you can be sure that you're close to the right view, close to seeing or seeing the world through Dharma eyes. Now, we should be clear that to see the world through Dharma eyes doesn't mean that you don't experience dukkha, that you don't experience some pain in life, some insecurity, some vulnerability, feel oppressed at times, stressed at times. It means you understand that this is the way it is, and there's a willingness and openness to experiencing things the way they are. We don't add to it by struggling against it. We accept the pain in life that is bound to come, that's inevitable. we accept the pressures in life, the vulnerabilities or the insecurities. And in that acceptance, in that understanding and in that acceptance is the sense of well-being. Now, the sense of well-being does not override the truth of dukkha, but it makes it possible to live with the understanding of dukkha, the understanding of the inevitability of pain in life. And this is really the benefit or the result of training our minds to see the world through Dharma eyes. It takes training. We can hear the Buddha's teachings. We can believe them. But actually learning to see the world through Dharma eyes and to establish that foundation of well-being within our own heart and mind is not a matter of belief. You can read and believe, but that won't do it. You actually have to train the mind to see in this way. And in the process, we're bound to uncover all of the spin that we've acquired. All of the ways of seeing the world, of understanding our life, of understanding others, all of those ways that don't work or that don't lead to the end of suffering. And this is what's painful. This is what makes it so hard. We have beliefs, assumptions, assurances, hopes, fantasies. We have all kinds of stuff in here, in our hearts and our minds, of how we'd like life to be, how we've been told life should be, how we've been told we could be. Coulda, shoulda, woulda, doulda. Well, that's not the way it is. Only we can see for ourselves the way it is. And it takes, I like the word willingness. Some call it courage. It takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot of endurance. It takes a lot of compassion for yourself, for others. And it takes a kind of fearlessness, a willingness to look your deepest fears right in the eye and ask yourself, is this okay? And if you come back with the answer, no, you'll suffer. Fear is a reality that, you know, most of us are going to deal with for a long time on this path of awakening. And to hide from it or to deny it or avoid it is not serving. It's not serving. But it's not easy. It's not easy to look at fear. But in the gentleness, really, of developing the continuity of attention, you get glimpses. You get glimpses of fear over and over again. Fear among many other skeletons in the closet, if you will. Things that we just rather not deal with. But we get glimpses, and in the glimpsing, we get a chance to adjust our misunderstandings. To see that as painful, as scary, as confusing as it is, you can be with it. You can open to it. You can touch it. If you don't have some expectation or judgment that it should be otherwise. As soon as one of those spins, one of those ways of misunderstanding that you've acquired from others asserts itself, takes over, or you don't see it in your mind, then you suffer. You reject it. You push away from the experience of fear. You push away from the experience of envy or whatever it is that's hard to open to. And so it takes hearing the right feeling. It takes hearing the possibility, hearing of the possibility that we can disentangle our hearts from spin. We can. It's not a belief, it's actual work. But it is the work of awareness to show us how to do that. You know, sometimes we hear the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha's teachings. You know, the first one is, you know, the truth of dukkha, there's pain, there's suffering, there's insecurity, vulnerability, and we stop there and we just say, geez, this is a little overwhelming. But actually there's a message of, I don't really want to say hope, I don't really want to say promise, but there's another message in there too, in the Third Noble Truth. There is a way to disentangle yourself from dukkha. There is a way. And the way is through the development of awareness. Awareness of how we speak and what's going on when we speak. The awareness of how we act and what's going on when we act in the world. And the awareness of our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, our judgments, our fears. It's all about awareness. So anything you do to cultivate awareness is developing greater capacity to see the world through Dhamma eyes. And it is seeing the world through Dhamma eyes that, as I said, establishes this foundation for a sense of well-being. Now, a sense of well-being doesn't mean that you don't experience pain, or that you don't experience fear, or that you don't experience any of the other difficult states of mind. But it means that you have an understanding, a basis for understanding how these experiences come into being. As I said, everything that we experience is natural. There are the laws of nature, if you will, that we are heir to. Of course, we know the biological laws. You know, mother, father, children, and everything else that unfolds from that. It's not like we have a choice in whether we want to believe the biological laws. It's like, that's the way it is. And the more accurately you understand the biological laws, the more effectively you can avoid whatever suffering is going to result from them. There are the physical laws. You know, the law of gravity is not a matter of belief. You can try not to believe it if you want to, but you can be sure you're going to suffer. Biological laws, there's physical laws. There are other laws which the Buddha understood. There are the laws about the mind. There are laws like the law of karma. The law of karma is a law unto itself. It's not a matter of belief if you're Buddhist or if you're the Buddha. It's not a matter of belief. It's something that the Buddha observed. For most of us, it's just a matter of, well, do you believe it or not? You know the law of karma. You know, if you act with a wholesome mind, you'll get pleasant results. If you act with an unwholesome mind, you'll get unpleasant results. And in the meantime, it might not happen this lifetime. There might be subsequent lifetimes or a whole series of lifetimes to get to experience both wholesome and unwholesome results. Do you believe that? Do you believe that you're just in the middle of a stream of lifetimes, you know, with a few hundred thousand already happened and a few hundred thousand ahead of you? Law of karma talks about that. It's hard to believe, isn't it? I mean, the only person putting out that spin is the Buddha. You know, you're not going to get anybody on Fox News telling you, you better vote this way because it's life. You know. Although I have heard that somebody recently has
gotten interested. It was an article on NPR about Western scientists' fascination with what seemed to be rebirth. And some little kids that can remember something. Anyway. So we have the law of gravity, or the physical laws, the law of seeds, sperm and eggs, if you will, biological laws, the law of karma. There's also the law that the Buddha discovered that governs the unfolding of the mind. The law that governs the unfolding of the mind, which, you know, in shorthand is, if you cultivate wholesome qualities of mind, you will eliminate unwholesome qualities of mind. And it happens through the stream of consciousness. Okay. There are other laws governing the unfolding of the mind that we're not very aware of. But you can be sure that there's no mistake. Can you imagine if you really believed it, that whatever you experience, whether it's pleasant or not, whether it's good health or not, whether it's abundance or not, it's not a mistake. It's not adventitious. It's not just happenstance. It's not just luck. It's a result of causes and conditions, which, if we understood them, we could live in alignment with. Practicing awareness is to learn to understand more, maybe not fully or completely, but to learn to understand the causes and conditions that give rise to suffering. So we practice not in order to kind of escape, you know, kind of the challenges of life. You know, if you're meditating, if you're taking up your meditation practice in order to kind of bliss out, kind of like get above it all, or get beside it all, or get outside of it all, well, that's a that's a pleasant, you know, kind of vacation. You still got to come back to work on it. It's good to know. It's good to go on vacations. You know, if you work 50 weeks a year, it's good to have two, go on vacation, get away from it. And so too, when you're working with the mind, it's good to be able to kind of check out skillfully. But it doesn't really bring the relief we're looking for. It is through understanding our suffering. It's through understanding what causes us to contract in life. It's through understanding what causes us to judge our experience as not okay. And when we understand that, we really don't have to live out of alignment with the truth. None of us would choose to do that. If you know, I mean, once you know, once any child knows that to put your hand in the flame causes pain, mostly they don't do it. If we understood what it was, what led to this suffering when we put our heart and mind in this way, we'd stop doing it. It's our work. This is our work. For those of us who've heard the Dharma, have grokked it, or have kind of taken it in on ourselves, and really imbibed it, and been, you know, as you say, drinking the Kool-Aid. If you've been drinking the Buddha's Kool-Aid, you understand this is our work, this is our job, this is the task ahead of us, to wake up to understanding. First, to understand all the ways that we misunderstand, to see, to recognize, to expose all the ways that we misunderstand our experience, or that we judge it. And to really look at where do these views and opinions come from? And once you see that they're not in alignment with the way things are within your own experience, then to have the courage to put them aside. To say, no, I've seen for myself, this belief does not lead to happiness. Put that aside.
even Dharma practice, is not something we can control. We have the intention to practice. We have the intention, as most of you must have, when we were sitting for 35 minutes, to be aware, to pay attention moment to moment to what your experience is. And while that intention is noble and wholesome and energized, we can't make it happen. I hope you saw that. You know, when we look, we see this is the way it is. We can't really control it. We can guide it, we can develop it, we can train the mind, but in any particular moment, it's not our prerogative to control it. We are a bundle of causes and conditions, just like everything else is a bundle of causes and conditions. Most of which we do not control. This is a reality, or this is a truth that's hard to see. Hard to see. That, you know, we're really... acting out the result of causes and conditions put into play, some by our own intention, many not by our own intention. So we need patience. We need a lot of patience to deal with the habits of mind, the misunderstanding, the way we misunderstand our experience, because they come up. They come into view. As we do our practice, difficult things come into view over and over again. So we need patience. But we also need persistence. We need the kind of energy that is willing to start again, try again, take another look, be willing to experience recurring experience over and over again until we understand it. To understand where the fear comes from in our life, how it is that we get identified with it. We have to see it more than once. We have to see fear a lot. And so it takes a willingness. You know, there isn't any one of us in the room that hasn't experienced fear, or maybe lives with kind of a low level, kind of stream of fear in our lives. Fear of what if I lose my job, if I can't pay the mortgage, or can't get a job, or whatever. And there's a lot of fears in here. It takes a lot of courage to look. But that's the way we're going to understand. Not by shrinking from, or turning away from, or minimizing, or denying, but from humble taking a look. You know, there are two attitudes of mind that really obstruct our willingness to practice the Dharma. And one of them is the attitude of mind of entitlement. Somehow we all get a sense of entitlement. This shouldn't be happening to me. You know, I'm better than that. I'm smarter than that. You know, whatever it is, whether it's being ashamed or being judged or criticized or fearful or envious or jealous or whatever it is, we think it shouldn't be happening to me, as if we're entitled to a life without that. And to see that sense of entitlement operating in our mind is very difficult. Whether it's gender entitlement, ethnic entitlement, class entitlement, economic entitlement, there are many different ways that we get entangled in, identified with a sense of entitlement. The opposite side, or the other end of the spectrum of entitlement, is feeling victimized. Feeling victimized by conditions, experiences, and using that as a defense against really looking at our experience and trying to understand it. When we feel victimized, it's like we're deflated. We feel overwhelmed. We feel impotent. That our efforts are useless. And so it's really hard to cultivate the willingness to engage the present moment, to really look at it. Again, exposing the victimized mentality is very difficult. It takes a steadiness of attention and to begin to recognize it and to see how it's playing out in our life. But they can be exposed, both the entitlement mentality and the victimized mentality, across every spectrum of our life. And when you find them, when you see them, when they kind of start chattering away in your heart, in your mind, recognize them. Have the courage to recognize and to humbly kind of step out of that spin. It's just a spin. We've learned it from someone, somewhere. It's not the way things are. And the sooner we see that and are willing and able to step out of it, the freer we become from suffering. This is what it means to see through Dharma eyes, to practice awareness, to look at our own experience, and to come to understand from our own understanding that this is the way to the end of suffering. This is the way to suffer less. To overcome our fear, stress, vulnerability, insecurity, whatever it is, all of those. This is our journey, and this is our opportunity, really, through hearing and practicing the Dhamma.